Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Wednesday, October 28th, 2015. It's a few minutes before 5 UTC. And before we get into the, first segment, here's what's going on this week kind of stuff, I just want to make sure right up front I get the agenda out. Our three main segments today are going to be the presidential election, of course, the shenanigans going on in Congress, both with the Speaker of the House race and also with the budget deal and all that kind of stuff. And then, just because we haven't done it for a long time, we're going to do just a segment on developments in the tech world on a whole bunch of different companies. And that's roughly where we are.
Yep.
Now,
I think this is the first time we've done this. We're in the same time zone.
We are in the same time zone, at which we are doing this a day earlier than we usually do and a couple hours later in the evening than we usually do.
Right. Yep.
Because Yvonne is in, where are you?
I'm in San Francisco.
San Francisco. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. At Oracle Open World.
Yes. I've been, going through that last couple of days, getting a little bit of information overload, if I'm honest. My head's spinning a little bit. I will say this, talking outside of the talk about tech.
Okay, right, talk about most of the conference stuff.
Yeah, we'll talk about. I was talking a little bit about the city a little bit and how it's changed over the last. I've been coming to San Francisco, regularly for the last 17 years. Okay. Right? On a pretty regular basis. They're the Bay Area, for that matter. I don't think I've gone more than, I haven't gone more than 24 months without being here. At least that's the most. I will say that over those 17 years, I must have been out here, 30, 40 times. It's a pretty good chunk.
Okay. So a couple times a year for a while.
Yep. Yeah. There were some times I would come five or six times a year, then the last couple of years, I've been over here about four times in the last five. So that's not that bad. Almost once a year, at least, even though I don't work for a company that is, based out of the Silicon Valley. We have operations over here, but it's not our key thing. There's a lot of social tension in this city. Okay. All right. Because of a lot of the changes. And, I can tell you can feel that a little bit, to a certain extent. There's been such an influx of tech money into the city. Whereas before, when you used to come over here, the city was the city. The guys in tech were out in Silicon Valley. Okay? They were out in Palo Alto and Cupertino, where Apple's based out of.
But not in San Francisco proper.
Not in San Francisco proper. Okay? All right? People came to San Francisco. We came to San Francisco proper for dinner sometimes and some stuff or whatever, but it's relatively far, especially with traffic and whatever. Really, a lot of these companies have really invaded the downtown because over the last 15 years, if you saw the trends in population in a lot of big cities in the U.S., including San Francisco, they had been on a downward trend, and then all of a sudden people have decided, living in the urban setting is not that bad. We want to be back in here. But the thing is that it's because of a lot of reasons. Many of them having to be with the fact that there's a lot of restrictions on construction, this and that or whatever. There's a significant housing shortage out here. Okay. To the point where I'm looking at, I was reading an article where the average rent for a studio apartment in San Francisco is $2,800 a month.
Yeah, right. Which is insane.
It's insane. Okay, all right. It's not affordable for so many people. And really, this mix of people that all of a sudden just with that much money, I'm it's all of you that have listened to the show. I'm not exactly known for a guy. To be with little money, okay, or to be shy about spending money or any of these things. But even if I found it a little bit everybody needs an opportunity to be able to live well, okay, all right? And it just seems like to me that the reality is that because of a lot of reasons, and I will tell you that in some cases, the guys who are liberals that are trying supposedly to protect those that don't have anything are making it worse, okay, has caused like a lot of more friction.
And it's so now you throw that out. What do you mean? How do the liberals make it worse?
Okay, they tried to restrict construction in general, mm-hmm. right? We don't want any more luxury developments. And I'm like, okay, look, the problem is that by doing that, you're limiting supply, which what it's doing, it's driving everything else price, including the prices of affordable places, down. Okay? The only way to get the prices to go down, honestly, is if they build more. Period. Because if you don't let them build a whole bunch of more luxury units, then it won't like reduce the pressure on other types of places where what they're doing is they're invading other areas where real estate is cheaper because they can't find a place and they're driving the prices up of places that are affordable. So, you know, it's a simple supply and demand thing, and you've got a lot of people over here to think that the solution is, let's just restrict construction so they can only build low-cost units. Well, fuck, for the most part, a lot of those low-cost units aren't not as profitable. You got to let them just fucking build anything. Just have more supply. It's a simple fucking equation. It's supply and demand. Fuck. I'm like, and or hell, if you want to tie the fact, hey, you want to sell the high profit ones, you need to build like a number of low priced ones. That's okay. Then they'll do that too. But you can't just go and like just say no building, because that's part of the problem that I'm seeing around here. I don't know. It's just a little bit like it's a little bit concerning. But you know. I know that there's a lot of people out here that are talking about trying to make this better and whatever, whatnot, but I just, you know, I can see how those tensions are exacerbated by, I think that people, I mean, there's just a lot of people with a lot of money out there in this mm-hmm. town right now and really making their presence felt. And it's pushing other people that have been used to being in this town and, you know, and didn't really need that much money to live, and all of a sudden it's turned into an unaffordable mess for a lot of people. And people have to have a right to be able to live, you know, and have a place, and be able to afford it. And it's just, I just don't see how $2,800 fucking dollars a month for a studio is really a reasonable number to anybody. I mean, people are not getting paid. I mean, their wages are going up, but they're not that much. I mean, you know, I mean, think about it. If you were trying to buy, look, if you think about your budget. If you were having to pay for a house like $6,000 a month to have a house, $6,000 to $7,000 a month, I mean, it'd be pretty tight.
I would be living in my car.
Right. You know? So, I don't know. I think my big concern is that it just seems like the groups aren't just getting together and doing something logical. I think you've got, like, it's almost the same thing as when we talk about congressional gridlock and some of the stuff that's happening. Is like, you know, as we talk about the polarization of America, even, like, things like this that should have some solutions that are relatively, like, easier aren't happening because we're just getting too many people that are just fucking becoming way too polarized over the solutions and come out with these stupid arbitrary things either on the left or the far right. And I just see that this is like some kind of microcosm of that happening to a certain extent.
Okay, so San Francisco, and you know, the same thing is happening in other places to greater yeah. or lesser degrees. Like, there's a lot of that same kind of talk in the Seattle area where I am, not yeah. quite to the extent that San Francisco is, but moving in that direction. And there's a lot of tensions around housing prices, housing availability, what kinds of things get built, zoning, all of that kind of stuff, for all of these same reasons, because certain companies are bringing in a whole lot of money and changing the character of a lot of areas of the city.
Yes.
Anyway, before we move on to our three real topics, I have one other thing for this starting up segment, which is I broke my foot.
Oh, boy, I forgot about Sam's broken foot.
So
God.
So
Sam, really?
for those of you who have not seen it on AbelSmay.com or on Facebook or wherever.
He's got the x-rays pictures up.
Yep. Yeah, I've got the x-ray pictures up. But the story basically goes like this. My six-year-old son, Alex, created an obstacle course in our driveway for me to do. And so it involved, like, first you bike through this one section, and then you jump off the bike, and then you run this other section. And, I mean, the whole thing was only, like, 15 feet long, okay? But the very beginning of it was two, you know, 10-foot-long wooden 4x4s stuck close together in sort of like a V shape. And I was supposed to ride my bike through that. Okay. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing, you know, and probably like if I was going full speed on my bike, no problem. It was like 6 inches or 7 inches between the two pieces of wood at the closest point. But the thing was the space I had to start up my bike before that obstacle was about 6 inches. You know, I maybe a foot or two. So basically, I got on my bike, I started going to that thing, and I was still going very, very slowly. And your typing is distracting, Yvonne. Stop typing.
Jesus, it's that loud? Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, I was trying to go through the thing. I was going very, very slowly. I was going kind of too slowly to really balance the bike properly. And so, because I realized I wasn't quite turned in exactly the right way, and my wheel was going to hit the wood and blah, blah, blah. So I slowed down, and so I started wobbling, and then I tipped over on my side. And so I fell to the left, and... you know, I fell over and my head bonked against my car, actually, which was near there. So I did hit my head, but not hard. And none of this was hard. I felt like I landed pretty softly. I'm like, ha, 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 I fell. Funny, funny. Ha, ha. Let me just pop right back up because I didn't feel any immediate pain or anything else like that. But my foot had landed sort of wedged between the 4x4 and my bicycle. And so when I popped up, when I tried to stand up, I very quickly realized that that hurt. Like I could not stand on my left foot at all. Any sort of movement or weight like made me want to scream. And typing is still really distracting, Yvonne.
Jesus, I'm okay. My God, I can't even hear it myself. Okay.
Anyway, so I basically hopped on one foot over to the steps and I sat there and my son ran into the house, got a first aid kit and came back with Band-Aids and such, which was very nice.
Not very helpful, but very thoughtful.
Very thoughtful, especially like that thing was high up on the shelf somewhere. So he went up and got it. But anyway, he got the first aid kit, got me some Band-Aids, some other supplies. And he was looking through it saying, will this help? Will this help? Will this help? He was trying really hard. But then my wife brought me some ice, wrapped it up with an ACE bandage, all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, okay, it'll be fine in a couple hours. It was not fine in a couple hours. You know, I fell asleep on the couch, and then
weren't you in pain when you fell asleep on the couch still?
Yes, I was in pain when I fell asleep on the couch.
And you still managed to fall asleep on the couch with that broken foot pain. Okay.
Yeah, so I fell asleep on the couch.
How long?
I don't know. I woke up at like 2 or 3 in the morning or something.
Jesus. Okay.
And then I'm like, I want to go upstairs.
So you could.
I tried to go upstairs. So I sort of hopped. I sort of hopped into the hallway, and the first thing that happened is as I'm hopping in the hallway, my left foot, my injured foot, like kicks into something, like a stool or something we had in the hallway, and like of course I scream or something.
Oh, and, God.
And, like, fall.
Wake up, everybody.
I scream. I fall over. My wife comes running. Are you okay? And I'm like, ah! And I managed to get myself up. She just goes back to sleep. I don't know. And then...
I like that plan.
Yeah. And then I continue my way towards the stairs and going upstairs. I basically Somehow I like crawled up the stairs or something, and every movement like was racked with pain. It took me probably about 15 minutes to get up the stairs from our first floor to our second floor. And then I just lay down in an upstairs hallway and went back to sleep, because the thought of going the additional 20 feet to my bedroom was, it just wasn't happening.
Nice.
And so I slept there another couple hours, and then I did manage to make it to the bathroom and the bedroom and stuff. But also I was crawling, every foot I moved was in pain. And so like the sun came up, you know, my wife, saw me bumbling around and whatever, and was like, yeah, you're going to the doctor.
Yeah. Thank God. Okay.
Because of course I'm like, it'll get better. Actually, by morning I was not saying that anymore. By morning, okay, I was like, yes, get me to the doctor. In a few hours, it happened Friday night around 7 p.m. And that evening I was like, yeah, let's do ice. Let's do wrap it up. That's cool. I'm sure it'll be fine in a few hours. But when it was still there in the morning, and I'd spent the night crawling around the house because I couldn't get anywhere. Yeah, no, I went to the doctor. They took x-rays. Yes, I'd broken my foot, and I'd broken it in like the one bone in the foot that's like the most weight bearing, I guess. I don't know the right way to say it.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
But anyway, it's like, cause there's certain bones in the foot that'll hurt like hell, but you can still kind of get by. This is one of the ones where like, yeah, okay. This is one where, if it gets this is an oversimplification, but the first doctor I saw on Saturday was like, this is the one bone in the foot that sometimes needs surgery to fix.
Ouch.
Because everything else, you throw a cast on it and, you know, whatever.
And it'll, right. They'll fuse back and heal. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're like, yeah, we'll send you to a specialist. But of course, I managed to get in on Tuesday, which, you know, the first thing they offered me was sometime in mid-November, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me, right? anyway, bottom line, I spent most of today, or most of Tuesday, in follow-up. I got the specialist looked at it, blah, blah, blah. Bottom line, I don't need surgery. I don't need a real cast. Having it in a boot is just fine, but I need to put, you know, essentially zero weight on it for 6 weeks.
Nice.
Yeah, and then they'll check it again. And if it's healed properly, I'm done. If it heals badly, then I may need to revisit surgery. The options. Yeah. But they did say, you know, hey, if I wanted surgery, I could potentially opt for surgery and it might heal faster. It's something like just letting it go. There's like a 20% chance that at the end of the 6 weeks, something else will be needed. Not necessarily surgery, but something.
Well, you got an 80% chance you're not going to need surgery. I mean, if right. I can avoid surgery, I'll avoid. I mean, if we got an 80% shot of not having surgery, I'd go with the 80%.
Exactly. And whereas they were like, you know, if you were really anxious about getting back on your feet as soon as you possibly could, surgery is the way to go. It's more than 80% in terms of the recovery rate right after surgery, and the healing is faster, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But it's freaking surgery.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
you want to try to avoid surgery.
Yeah. So I'm like, you know, look, I'm lucky. I've got a job where I can essentially work from home. I'm basically planning on working from home for most of the next month, and I've got a job where that's possible.
Okay.
You know, and so
they already know that you've got your foot, you're laid out.
They already know. And, you know, look, I probably, you know, after I get used to the crutches a little bit, it's my left foot, so I can theoretically still drive. After I get used to getting around a little bit more than I am now, I can probably come in. I'll probably still only do it when there's something that like is really meaningful to be in for, but you know, not just to go in. But I can get by. Oh, and one other thing about this story that I wanted to mention today for my follow-up appointment with the specialist, I had to go into Seattle to Harborview Hospital. If anybody listening is in the area and knows what that is. And so they said, you know, it's the building you want to go to is at such and such corner. Fine. I had my mom actually took me. We took my son into school early and we went and we got to that corner. And at one point I'm like, look, the sign says parking to the left, but she missed it. She went past that. And then I'm like, fuck it. Just park, just park, just park. And then we'll figure it out. Right. So the next parking garage we went to was for the main hospital. And this is apparently the thing I was in was in an annex building, but it's an old, old parking garage. And you'd think being at a hospital, they would think about these things. But there was no easily accessible elevator in the damn parking garage.
Oh, God.
We parked five levels down in the goddamn parking garage because that was the first available parking.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go up five fucking flights of stairs on my goddamn crutches.
There was no elevator. Oh, my God. I figured maybe it took you a little bit to get to the elevator, but there's no freaking elevator.
There was an elevator on like level three. So if I'd gone to five to three, there was an elevator. But here's the thing. The elevator was completely fucking on the other side of the parking garage from where we were.
Oh, boy.
So once I got to level three, I'm looking at the stairs versus I'm looking walking like a football field or two down the other way to the elevator. I'm like, fuck it. I'm just going up the other three flights of stairs. And so I went up five flights of stairs, and then because we didn't, you know, the building I actually wanted to, of course, had its own parking garage, but we didn't know this stuff, and we didn't know exactly where we were going. So after I got up the five flights of stairs, I had to go, like, it was like two, maybe two and a half blocks on the crutches. And, like, look, I know there are people who are used to being on crutches. There are people who've been on crutches long term. I had been on crutches for less than 48 hours and had never been on them before, was not used to it. So, okay, five flights of stairs, two and a half blocks.
That's exhausting.
I was wiped. I was so done by the time we even got to the
look, I was on crutches once. I was like, 8 years old. Look, I remember the first few days was horrible, but after a while, you get really used to it. I mean, you know, yeah. I was moving around. I had to spend 6 weeks on crutches. I mean, I was moving around like a rocket on them after a while.
I mean, I suspect by the end of the 6 weeks, I'll be much more used. Like you said, you get used to it. You figure out what you can do. You get the technique down, all that kind of stuff.
I was on crutches. What the heck was it? It was not that long ago. Well, 3 years ago.
And, that's right.
It was exhausting at first, but, you know, like I said, I got used to it, like, you know, started getting used to it.
Yeah. Not quite there yet. I bet before this morning, the longest trip I had made on my crutches was the like 20 feet from the living room to the bathroom. And so, I was so done, and I ended up, we had the appointment was supposed to be at 9:30. We were a few minutes late for it, but I was there having them doing stuff and poking and prodding me and looking at me until around 11:30 or something. But my mother had to leave to go pick up my son from school because they're getting out early because of parent-teacher conferences or whatnot. So I just had to sit there in the freaking waiting room for another 2.5 hours before getting picked up as well. And I hadn't brought my work stuff. Because I was like, I'm going to a doctor's appointment. While I'm at the doctor, I'm going to be thinking about that. And so I got home just in time for a conference call in the afternoon. And I'm like, I am so done. I am so done. And anyway, so that's my story. I'm going to be on in this boot. They did give me a lighter boot, though. Like, I had this big, huge monstrosity. And now it's basically just a light boot on my foot. And
so can you step on the boot or do you need to use?
I'm allowed to put, if it doesn't hurt, I'm allowed to put weight on my heel, but only on my heel.
On their heel. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, so this light thing, I mean, I'm supposed to take it off like three times a day and exercise the foot. So I actually took it off for the podcast because it's like this new lighter one is a lot is less uncomfortable than the big heavy one, But it's still
it's better than having a cast.
It's better than having a cast.
Oh my God, I remember.
I've never had a cast. This is my first broken bone of my life. 44 years. This is my first broken bone.
Well, that's pretty damn good. Okay, yeah. I got it, but that's not bad.
Okay, we've gone on long enough. Sorry to ramble on about my wonderful foot. Anyway, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the presidential election. We'll do Congress. We'll do tech. And if we have time and we feel like it, we'll do a lightning round. Otherwise, you know, screw it. We'll see how it goes. We'll be back after this.
You're in the Valley, AM 1620 and LiganairRadio.com. This is where you'll find your favorite songs. Everybody's doing a brand new dance now. Come on, baby. Let's do the
twist. Well, they got a new dance and they go like this. I hit the radio dial and tune it up all the way. I got a dance.
Classic music for a classic American town, AM 1620, and in stereo at LiganairRadio.com, The Valley.
Do. This is Sam from the future. Yvonne and I recorded this the day before the Republican debate on CNBC this week, so obviously we didn't really talk about it in our segment. But as I'm putting this together, the debate has in fact just ended. Well, maybe half an hour to an hour ago now. In any case, I thought I would include a few of my right after the debate thoughts here. So first of all, I think Rubio and Cruz did very well. They're going to, I think, improve in the polls over the next couple weeks. I think Trump and Carson were basically flat. They didn't really do anything to hurt themselves, but they didn't shine in a way that would bring more towards them. I think the same is roughly true of Fiorina. She got to talk a lot, but I don't think it's enough to, like, shoot her up again, but it's enough probably to stop her from falling further, which originally, as the debate was starting, I thought she'd fall further, but I think she did okay enough to keep that from happening. So maybe flat. Down, Bush. Bush just once again completely fell on his face. And by the way, I'm paralleling some of what I said on Twitter about this during and immediately after the debate. But Bush just continued to do badly. He looked like he was done. He didn't have it in him. Like, he tried to pick a fight with Rubio and he lost. He's got money to stick around a while if he even feels like he wants to. And that potentially lets him sort of hope that other people fall out and he gets another chance, in December or January. But he's looking so done. He needs like a complete turnaround if he's gonna start coming back, and it's not looking that way right now. So near the halfway point in the debate, I predicted that after the debate was done and the polls factored everything in, the only candidates over 5% would be Trump, Carson, Rubio, and Cruz. I now grant that maybe Fiorina will still be in that group. She was at 5.8% right before the debate, and if she doesn't really fall, maybe she'll stay right around that level and barely make it into the 5%. But I think Bush, who is at 7% in the Real Clear Politics average, is going to drop below 5%. I mean, at best, he's going to be flat, but I think he drops further. He just did very badly. And so what does that mean going forward? Everybody still expects Trump and Carson to sort of flare out. And if they do, we're left with the top candidates being Rubio and Cruz, really. I don't think Fiorina gets into that top tier quite. Oh, and by the way, all the other candidates I didn't mention, they don't matter. They're done. They're out. They just don't really know it yet. Christie actually had a fairly decent night, but I think it's too little too late. It's not going to be enough to get him into that top tier we talk about. But yeah, we might have a Rubio Cruz race if Trump and Carson really do just collapse at some point. I speculated on Twitter, maybe Fiorina for VP. I don't know. And I said this on Twitter as well. I know I'm basically looking at my Twitter stream. Everybody wants to count Trump out, don't count him out yet. He was clearly off tonight. He's clearly rattled a little bit by not being number one anymore in a lot of polls. And so he's a little shaken and he's off his game, but, you know, he has this ability to just find people's weak spots and exploit them mercilessly. And he kind of did that with Bush over the last month or so, certainly helping with Bush's decline, although Bush helped a lot on that himself. At today's debate, he did that with Kasich, but I mean, nobody was really supporting Kasich anyway. So the fact that Trump kind of put the knife in and twisted. Okay, you know, you devastated Kasich, but it was Kasich. But Trump has that ability. So if it does end up, you know, Rubio, Cruz, Carson, you know, watch out for Trump, you know, turning his gaze upon them. As for Carson, I still just don't get it. I mean, he was himself, and in any normal world, the way he is would disqualify him immediately. But we're not in that normal world, so I sort of predicted he'd stay flat. I said Trump and Carson roughly flat, but there was a little bit of a trend for Carson to be catching up with Trump. I don't know if this halts that or not. I could see them flipping places in national polls easily, but I don't know. We'll find out, I guess. Anyway, those were my quick thoughts on the debate. I'm sure Yvonne and I will talk more about the fallout in next week's show, and we may even have a few polls to see if any of the predictions I just made are correct or not. Chances are most of them will be wrong. That's usually how it works. But, you know. Anyway, back to our election 2016 conversation, which happened before this debate. So just keep that in mind. Do, do, do. Okay, welcome back.
I am back. And oh, by the way, this week I have a hotel room that actually has a desk with a real chair, and I'm sitting there instead of
You're not lying down.
No. Plus, we're not listening to the long ass, long winded, boring debate either. So, you know, and I took my allergy medication.
They're good job. Now, the only other thing you have to work on is being still and not touching things while you talk.
Gee, for the love of God, what is this? What the hell is this? I have noticed that this microphone on this headset is more sensitive and less directional than the one I normally use when I'm at home.
There you go. Like anytime you touch something, you move a piece of paper, you rustle, you like turn. It's like I can feel your shirt moving against your skin or something.
Okay. So basically you're telling me I have to be like standing still here like a statue?
Pretty much, yeah.
Fuck.
Anyway, let's hit the election 2016.
I'll try to do my best not to move.
Yeah,
okay?
There you go. Yeah, just be frozen. Oh, frozen, Yvonne.
Okay. Jesus Christ.
Let's start with the Democrats. There haven't been any real additional big national polls since we talked last week. But when there have been various state polls. I mean, the bottom line is,
well, the moron quit. I mean, Chafee. Okay, Mr. Webb's out. Fucking like read legislation. Oh yeah, I got to Congress and they gave me this bill and I just fucking voted for it and I didn't know anything, which I wanted to just punch. I swear to God, I wanted to punch him dead in the face.
Yes.
I mean,
anyway, bottom line is, you know, there haven't been any big national reputable additional polls since last week, but every new state poll that comes out shows Hillary with a commanding lead, taking the lead in like Iowa, New Hampshire again, she's now looking at Iowa.
I mean, she's a lock. And I mean, the thing is that, you know, she got dragged out to frickin',
Sanders is still very, very slightly ahead in New Hampshire in the poll average, but...
Yeah, but still.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just New Hampshire. I mean, I look, She went out and she got dragged out to frickin', you know, to Congress over this whole Benghazi thing, right?
Yeah, okay? Let's talk about Benghazi. That happened after our last show.
Yeah, I mean, so she got dragged out, right? And what happened?
Oh, she crushed it. Now, more than nothing, she came out of that with a big bump. She looked great in that hearing. Everybody questioning her looked like idiots. They made fools of themselves, and they knew it is the thing. Like, you could tell to some degree they were getting more and more frustrated because they knew they were coming off as dicks and assholes without, like, actually making any of the points they wanted to make.
Right.
Meanwhile, Hillary was, you know, knocking back everything they had in a way that made, you know, to use the word, made her look presidential. She looked
right.
She had a command of what was going on. She had answers to everything that was brought up. If she didn't have an answer, she had a good way to talk about, you know, well, here are the situations and here's who would know and here's who, blah, blah, whatever, you know.
Look, she came out looking presidential. You know, we were, a lot of the stuff that had been coming out before in interviews and things that she was doing is that she was looking like an asshole.
Yes.
She had been looking, I mean, just uncomfortable, talking about stuff. She had been like just looking, just all her like motions and like just body language was sucked. Okay. And then I don't know what the hell she did. I don't know. You know, I don't know, maybe she was being cocooned too much without being in front of everybody because, you know, she had been avoiding the press forever in questions. But she came out in the debate and just fucking, like, you know, came out looking presidential, came out looking great. And then she got grilled in front of Congress for how long was this?
11 hours.
11 hours, for God's sake. It's ridiculous. Okay. And she came out looking great again.
Yep.
I mean, after 11 hours of fucking grilling. I mean, you know, shit, what the hell else can you ask for?
And
I mean, she really big time turned around a lot of perceptions from a lot of people that were feeling, maybe it's not, I'm saying that they were going to support somebody else, but that they were getting like nervous about supporting her.
Yes.
Okay.
And she turned that around. And what we, you know, what we've said before, there are two things that we've mentioned in previous shows. One is that she has a reputation in these things of starting out really rough and then at some point sort of, you know, catching her wind and getting the knack of it and then running for the end. And it certainly seems like something turned around in how Hillary is approaching the world about a month ago. And it's showing in these things. The other is, of course, that she has never, like, at her worst point in looking at the polling averages, her worst point ever, she was at 41% and Bernie was at 27.
But that was like, was that considering Biden in the race?
Yes, that's considering Biden.
Right.
So she was always ahead in this game.
Right.
The odds were always that she was going to be the nominee.
Right.
But, you know, in my own estimation on how I was going through this, it went from being around 80% for most of last year through this year to when she was in a constant decline, basically from July through September. Every single thing was down, 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 down. And in the head-to-heads with the Republicans, that started even earlier. But I'm just talking the Democratic race right now. So the question was not, is she ahead? Because she was always still ahead. And at
right.
the worst point, I dropped her odds down to 60%. But
right.
60% is still, she's probably the winner.
Right.
And I think she's turned that around. And we're back up in 80% plus territory with the only way
there
she
was
loses.
One poll where I saw where they had done the consideration of whether it's Biden in or Biden out.
There right? have been several of those, and basically they showed that with Biden still in the race, she was, you know, in the 40s.
Under 50%. Right.
Under 50%.
Yeah.
With Biden out, she was at like around 60%.
Close to 60. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Which matches my estimates of about 70% of Biden supporters going to her. You know, and so we'll see. Like, again, like, she does have a tendency to shoot herself in the foot. She's had a few really good weeks here.
I tell you what, but she's really, really, really turned it around where she was looking at, where she was coming off in all these fucking interviews looking like a moron.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, because she did a series of them back to back that it was just, you're like, what the fuck, man? I mean, it was just like one bad one after another. And then I don't know what the hell. It's just something just it clicked in her. She just stopped and she's just fucking, you know, turn it around big time. And just stop coming off like that anymore.
Yeah. So we'll see. If she can keep this up, then I expect that she will fully consolidate the Democratic thing. And the thing. See how articulate
thing.
I am there.
Oh yeah, the thing. Of course. I'm also on the thing.
But then she starts working on the Republicans.
Right.
So, you know, she had this period where she had to worry about Bernie Sanders. She had to worry about Biden. They're basically out of the way now.
I take it you're saying she wasn't worried about Weber or Chafee or those guys.
No, but she's petrified of O'Malley.
Oh,
and maybe wow. Lessig. Maybe Lessig.
God.
Anyway, but she's done. You know, she does not have to worry about the Democrats again unless something dramatic happens and unexpected. So now she can turn her sights on the Republicans where, you know, again, and I'll tout electiongraphs.com, the trends specifically against, Biden and Rubio have been, she's been doing worse, not Biden, Bush and Rubio is she's been doing worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. You know, and a little bit less so with the other candidates, but she wasn't looking, you know, she looked at like, she's got a solid thing against most of them, but some of them like Trump and Carson are actually very competitive. There's not a lot of polling there, but you know, she's got stuff to worry about, bottom line. But now she can start concentrating on the general election.
Right.
And meanwhile, the Republicans can't yet. The Republicans, and we're going to start talking about them
even,
in just a
second. They're not even close. The Republicans are...
Yeah, the Republicans can't even get close to... Their concentration still is the Republican race and is going to be for a long time. Hillary can move on to consolidating her base, making...
Raising more money.
Republicans, pointing out the crazy stuff that the Republicans do.
The Republicans, honestly, have wound up helping her a lot.
Right.
To be honest with this shit.
So I expect, it's not reflected in any of my poll tracking yet, but I suspect that Hillary's downward decline in the general election is going to, at the very least, pause and level off and maybe start reversing over the next few months now that she can start really concentrating on the general.
I agree.
We'll see. So now let's talk about Republicans.
Okay. So. There's been a number of polls coming out that show that Trump's numbers are finally, that he's finally losing a lot of steam.
So let's look specifically, because again, this is one of the areas where you got to be careful not to cherry pick. But they're on the national polls, Real Clear Politics now includes one poll that has Carson ahead of Trump nationally. If you look at the whole average, Trump still beats Carson by 5%, approximately 4.8%. But Carson is gaining on him. But the one that and we'll see if more if over the next week, if more polls narrow that gap further. But like we talked about last week, it's like Carson's losing ground. But who's he losing ground to? He's losing ground to Carson.
Trump's losing ground.
Trump is losing ground to Carson, not to Rubio, not to Bush,
right.
Not to Cruz, not to Fiorina, not to any of these other guys. He's losing ground to Carson.
Like a lot of it.
But
in Iowa, there's a number. It wasn't just one poll. There's a number of polls.
I was getting to that. In Iowa, there have been a number of polls putting Carson ahead. And even in the average now in Iowa, Carson is at 29%. Trump is at 21%.
Right.
And
Trump was solidly ahead in Iowa, and now
Carson
he's
has
not.
Carson has a solid lead in Iowa, which led Trump. You know, I'm not going to get the exact wording here, but he was at a rally in Iowa today, and basically is like, "What the hell are you guys doing to me? I don't like being number two. Fix this."
That was a skip. I love it.
Yeah, that's basically what he was saying. And then he also went on to say, well, you know what they say, the winner of Iowa doesn't really mean anything.
Oh, now he's downplaying Iowa. There you go. Great. There
and he's
go.
Doing it in Iowa, which always plays well.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm looking at the chart. Okay. All right. And it's just, you know, look how crazy. The Iowa chart. Okay. On Real Clear Politics. Okay. And it's just bonkers. I mean, you know, well, like this entire cycle has been bonkers for Republicans. We just see this chart where it was like, you see this yellow line here, which I believe was Bush. Okay.
No, the golden line was Walker.
Walker was ahead in Iowa?
Well, yeah, he's from a neighboring state, remember. Yeah, Walker was ahead in Iowa for most of the last year.
So that was Walker. Okay, I was like, okay, so great. So even worse. So Walker was all the way leading through August. Okay, right? Okay, then all of a sudden, Trump, like, surges like a rocket first. Then Carson, right after him, surges as well. And then all of a sudden, you're seeing, for whatever the hell, I'm still trying to figure out what the hell happened in the last 2 weeks that has made like Carson just skyrocket at the expense of Trump. What the hell happened?
Who the fuck knows?
I mean, it's like, because it's not, you know what? It's not a little bit like a trend thing. I mean, if you look at this chart in Real Clear Politics, it's like, I mean, it took off like he had a rocket up his ass. I mean, he went from like 17% in the polls to 29.2.
Now, the one thing that we don't have a lot of visibility on, looking at this nationally in the way we are, is the candidates are spending a lot of advertising money in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Well, I get that, but Jesus Christ, I mean, I've never seen, I mean, I don't care how much money you've spent. I mean, Bush has been plowing money into Iowa.
And it's doing nothing.
And it's doing nothing. You mean to tell me, like, all of a sudden Carson's buddy just got him, like, fucking, like, a surge of, like, 50%. I mean, almost like a 50% surge in his numbers, just like that?
So this is a good point. There was an article I tweeted earlier today that I'm bringing up right now. In the Washington Post, basically saying, what is the appeal of Trump and Carson right now?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, my computer is being dead slow, so I'll get to it in a minute.
Yeah.
I'll edit this part out. Snip, snip. Okay. The article is The Appeal of Donald Trump and Ben Carson Explained in 38 Words.
38 words.
By Chris. That's good. Chris Caliza.
Yeah.
Who's The Fix on Twitter, who, by the way, is a good one to follow. He's got some good stuff, along with Philip Bump and The Washington Post. Anyway, there was a focus group run by a Democratic pollster at the University of Pennsylvania. And a stupid webpage wants Flash. And turn off Flash. No. Okay. Ah! Okay. Anyway, there's one comment from one woman who identified herself as a Trump supporter that stood out to him, and he wanted to call out. Because basically, everybody who's like establishment is like, I don't understand what's going on. What's going on? What's going on with Trump? What's going on with Carson? I have no freaking idea. So the quote is, America doesn't want a politician. We're sick of career politicians. We did what we were supposed to do. We wrote the letters. We made the phone calls. And they did not listen. And we're out to clean house. And, you know, look. People are always sick of the politicians.
I've heard this all my life.
But what they're saying here is specifically Republican voters feel like they were kind of, they Duped. Were promised a lot.
They were
sort of told that if they voted Republicans for the House and the Senate, things would change. But they
and
didn't.
Nothing happened.
And nothing happened. At least not what everything they wanted. And so they feel betrayed. And that sort of gets some of this stuff going out. You know, and you know, the article goes out and points out, like, part of this is, of course, a lot of people just fundamentally don't understand how American government works. You know, the whole checks and balances thing and the fact that, you know, you elect a Republican Congress but a Democratic White House, then neither one of them are going to get done the things they want.
Well, the problem is that these people have been wanting to, like, shove stuff down the other guy's throat, right? And it's just, you know, as my buddy Boehner, you know, has basically been pissed off trying to explain to people, it just doesn't fucking work that way.
Right. Yeah, and so you get a lot of people frustrated that, you know, hey, we voted in these people so that we could balance the budget, stop gay marriage, increase defense, get rid of welfare, whatever the, you know, all of those, and it didn't happen.
You know, eliminate Obamacare, repeal Obamacare, repeal and replace.
Exactly.
Whatever the fuck that means.
And so you got a lot of frustrated people saying, you know, hey, we tried that. We elected your guys. It didn't do anything.
But the funny thing is, okay, yeah, but the funny thing is that they're voting for guys. Because like we said with Trump, Trump actually is in favor of single-payer health care.
Yes.
I mean, you idiots. Great. So you're voting against those guys, and you're voting for a guy that is for something you have been, like, freaking, like, saying is the end of the world. Right?
Right.
I mean, what the fuck is wrong with you? That's your change? I don't get it. Look, I understand their frustration, but at the same time, look, they got... They were sold a certain bill of goods by voting these guys in, and these guys basically have done nothing. They have been, it's been one of the most ineffectual Congresses we've had in history, okay, in terms of getting anything done. So, they've not been able to deliver the goods, so they've got a lot of pissed off people in their hands.
And the thing is, the way things structurally are right now, that's probably true. Almost, I mean, unless you end up with one of the parties sweeping Congress and the White House,
right?
And with a 60 vote majority,
with 60% majorities, basically.
And even more than that, to be honest. I mean, because remember, like Obama had that for a little while at the beginning of his administration,
it was still difficult to get stuff through because even inside those groups, people have different, you know, agendas and opinions. Now he did get stuff through.
He got a number of things. I mean, this is where Obamacare comes from. Is from that.
But the one thing is that even Obamacare was a series of compromises. It sure as hell was not, you know, what the people that were envisioning it was, you know, at the as they were pie in the sky.
Right.
It wasn't. I think the point is that even if you have those majorities, whatever you still do requires a certain level of compromise. And you've got a good chunk of the Republican electorate that is not, doesn't want that, is not looking for that. They want, like, basically just to ramrod their agenda in front of everybody. And just right now they're just pissed off as all can be because they just can't seem to do it. So they're just fucking lashing out in every direction. That's what it seems like.
Yeah, and so, but I think if the polls continue in their current trends, we're going to have Carson in the lead very soon. and we're going to see how Trump reacts to being number two.
Which at least, you know, but by the way, at least it confirms that we were not wrong.
Yes, yes. Now what?
Trump it took is, longer than we expected, but
Trump
it's happening.
Trump is now promising to throw money at this, as much money as he possibly can, to get back on number one. If he,
of course, now they're now, two. Of course, they're. It's being found out that he's barely spent really any money,
right?
And that, oh, by the way, that he's actually getting donations.
Yeah, well, and he hadn't spent very much yet because he didn't need to.
Right. All he's of this all huge free publicity.
All of
he's
this
getting,
huge.
Everything
free
was free.
Yeah,
he's getting free publicity left and right. That's right.
So now we'll see how Carson does in the number one spot, assuming the trends continue. And that'll be amusing. And, you know, meanwhile, I was about to wrap this up, but I forgot one important thing, too. Bush is significantly cutting back his campaign.
Well, Bush reorganized. Yeah, Bush significantly reorganized his campaign. Yes, I think that, you know, what he did was that he had set up his campaign with a very expensive operation of shock and awe based out of Miami.
Jack shit.
None of that shit happened. And so he basically had to just completely restructure.
Yeah.
You know,
And, you know, the other things, there were a couple articles that came out about the Bush campaign and their strategy and blah, 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 blah. And the other thing that came out of that is, despite everything that's happening, they're apparently spending most of their time being worried about Rubio.
Right.
They're basically still all in the mode of Trump and Carson are going to go away. It's just inevitable. No matter what, we don't even have to like fight them because they're going to self-destruct on their own. And there is at least some, there are some, you know, reasons to think that. I mean, one example, I've seen a couple of analyses that say the lead that they have disappears if you go from registered voters to likely voters. So a lot of the people saying they are for Trump or Carson are the kind of people who probably won't actually show up and vote anyway.
It may very well be. I would not discount that.
So that's part of it. So maybe they're right. But at the other hand, you know, it seems like a crazy strategy for the guy who's in number five to concentrate all his effort on the guy who's number
three.
Yeah.
In Iowa. Right.
In Iowa. Yeah. And so and not even nationally. excuse me. And meanwhile, like, OK, even if you buy, you know, Trump and Carson, well, what about Cruz? You know, Cruz has had more luck fundraising than any of these other guys.
Yeah.
And he's right up there with Rubio and Bush. He's like right below them at the moment in the national polls.
You know, Santorum is still in this race.
Yes, Santorum is still in this race.
I just looked at the numbers and I just popped out of me. I'm like, Jesus, Santorum's still there. Fuck. He's not going to be at the CNBC debate tomorrow, right?
No. They have an undercard debate as well.
But he's not at the main.
He's not at the main event. Yeah. yeah. But Graham, Santorum, Jindal, and Pataki are indeed still in the race.
Graham, Santorum. Oh man, you know, I wish I had the time to do something like that. You know, wouldn't it be great? I mean, we just go out there and we get like, you know, half a point. We're just out there, whatever. We get invited to be, you know, talk bullshit or whatever. You know, yeah, sounds like, you know, if you got the money for it, it's not a bad gig, I guess.
No, and your favorite, before we wrap up this segment, Fiorina was also caught sending out private emails saying that even though she's still campaigning, she's available for paid speeches.
I don't think she's going anywhere. I mean, she's like, right now, I'm looking at the Real Clear Politics average right now in Iowa. She's at 3.8. I mean, she's... whatever. She's done. You're not going anywhere.
Let's take a break. We'll come back and talk about all the goings on in Congress. Back after this. Okay, we are back. So Congress. First of all, I did insert a brief note in last week's show, since there was a delay before I put it out, saying that since Yvonne and I last talked about this, it does look like Ryan basically agreed to be speaker without all his demands being met.
At least, yeah. I mean, he got some of his demands met, but not, you know, it wasn't 100%.
He didn't get the whole deal, and he didn't get, like, you know, some of the
most... Well, he compromised.
Yeah, well, he compromised, which is one of the reasons that people are like, Ryan would be okay, is he compromises. But the key is, he didn't get the fundamental changes that would keep them from kicking him out in between terms.
Mm-hmm.
And so there might still be some rules changes, but he agreed that there would be like a committee to look at that or something afterwards. So who knows what the hell is going to come out of that? You know, so, you know, we basically said last week, this puts him in a potentially weak position coming in, and there may, and we'll talk about the budget deal in just a second. The bottom line in terms of where Ryan comes in, and they were planning this all along, is to do the budget deal while Boehner was still there. So that Ryan would have his hands clean of that. And in fact, he's come out against the deal. Sam from the future here again. One slight correction / update to what I said there. He came out against the deal in that he thought it was a bad deal. He didn't like the deal. He railed against the process that led to the deal. But then later on, after Yvonne and I had recorded this, he said that he would in fact vote for the deal because even though it was a bad deal that he didn't like, it was the best available option right now. So read that as you will. So basically, they're kicking that down the road quite a ways, and he won't have to deal with it for a while. But when he when he does have to deal with it, who knows? All kinds of things may be different.
Well, I mean, look, they made a deal that it's basically lasts almost 2 years.
Right. It kicks it past the presidential election.
Absolutely.
And the next election for the House, obviously, as well.
And they compromised on a whole bunch of things, on the sequester, on a whole bunch of stuff. Basically, all the shit that the guys who hate Boehner, Bonner, Booner, whatever, Jesus, Boehner. You know, that these guys were hating him for. And, you know, it's going to get through. And with, you know, and I'm like, you know, and they're all up in arms about it. But at the same time, I mean, you know, actually, Boehner's words were something he used a little bit of an expletive saying something about, I didn't want him to walk into this shitstorm.
Uh-huh.
Something like that, you know? I mean, I just, you know, I wasn't just going to leave him this mess behind.
Well,
you know.
And I think that was his plan all along, like I said, was to, like, let's get all of these controversial things done while I'm still speaker. Basically, he constructed this whole I'm resigning and get a new speaker in such a way that he could do this one last time and they can't like kick him out for it because he's already leaving. But he's going to do this one last time and they're kicking it down the road as far as they. I mean, 2 years is like as far as you can imagine them doing this.
Right.
Because usually they've been kicking it down the road like a few months.
No, this time he's. He basically sacrificed himself to buy us a couple of years of fiscal sanity to a certain extent. So
what else is in this deal? I mean, I know there was one thing where they're renaming. I just want to put this out.
Okay.
Along with all the other stuff, they put into this major deal thing, something to rename one of the smaller rotundas in the House part of the Capitol building to the Freedom Foyer.
What?
Yes, the Freedom Foyer.
That's because?
Because they like it.
Okay.
And, you know, why not put it in, like, the bill that's, like...
Sure.
Doing, you know.
Yeah, okay, sure. The Freedom Foyer. Great.
Okay, go ahead.
Now,
what are the things that actually matter?
Well, the main things is, number one, they made changes to the sequester capture that basically we're going to allow spending for both domestic programs and for defense to both rise. Okay.
With a greater rate of increase for the defense.
Correct. Actually, they were supposed to rise like pretty similar according to the chart that I was looking at.
I think, okay, I read the defense rises are greater, but that may be because they're starting from a larger baseline.
It may be, because I was looking at the chart. They fixed the problem that we were going to have with Social Security disability, where it was going to run out of money. Now it says the current proposal would raise the sequester caps for another 2 years and ensures that spending rises equally for defense and domestic budgets. And I'm reading this right now from the chart that I was saying. That's why I was like surprised that you said that right. defense would rise faster. They were fixing Social Security disability, which was going to run out of money because that was a problem. They did a fix as well to fix a problem that was with Medicare Part B premiums, where about a third of people enrolled, if this didn't happen, their premiums were going to shoot up like 50%. They also did a change in the health law 2010 requiring employees to automatically enroll workers in company plans, which they deleted that provision. They did some tax change as well regarding partnerships, in which it made the tax rules simpler for for partnerships. There was a lot of stuff in here. I was surprised at the
scope.
Yeah, of things that they agreed to. Basically, because lately we've just been getting nothing. I mean, it's just stuff like just kicking it down the can and just one thing here and one thing there. I mean, this is a lot of stuff. And I'm sure that I'm just going through the highlights. I'm sure that there was more stuff. You talked about the Rotunda part. I had not heard about that part. Okay. Myself. So.
This looks like it's once again going to be one of those things that passes with Republicans plus Democrats.
Correct. Right? You know, yep. That's the expectation.
And the Freedom Caucus is going to, you know, pout and sit on their hands and make a fuss, but they're not going to be able to do anything about it.
They're not going to be able to do one damn thing.
And nope. Then Bonnier's out and Ryan's in. And Ryan doesn't have to deal with this for a long, long time.
That's right.
And so he can right now be sort of saying, this is an awful deal. I hate it, which he's been saying those kinds of things. He says this is structurally silly or whatever. I don't have his exact quote, but basically he's been railing against this deal. And whether or not he actually believes that is irrelevant. He's saying what he needs to say for the conservative folks. And he doesn't actually have to do anything based on that for a long time. And who knows what the situation will be in 2017. It's going to be potentially different than it is now. And even if it's exactly the same as it is now, he can make that call then.
Yep. He can make that call then. So that was one thing. There was another thing that also was an agreement that I think that Boehner, or whatever, Jesus Christ, at least we don't have to say his name anymore, probably in the near future, agreed, which was there was a controversial thing where the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which is another thing that the Freedom Caucasers have been against, was shut down. Okay.
Okay.
And that Export-Import Bank had been a key bank to help finance large foreign industrial purchases, such as buying aircraft from like Boeing, buying like large like electricity generation equipment from like General Electric, equipment from like Caterpillar. These were like, you know, the crux about it, or people were really upset, especially business people, is that this really helped, you know, for all of those that are bitching about manufacturing suffering in the U.S., this damn thing really, in the eyes of a lot of people, helped, you know, grease the wheels to sell large manufactured products in the U.S., okay, to foreign buyers. And for whatever the hell damn reason, the Freedom Caucus had this thing in their gun sights for no particularly good reason that I could really, like, you know, think of. But somehow the Boehner finally got a deal where there was enough people in Congress to get this thing through, and they're going to reauthorize the damn thing. So that was a lot, you know, between those two things, to get all that done, because that had been hanging in the balance for for a long time.
And all so, you have to do is have a lame duck speaker who doesn't give a shit anymore.
Exactly. Basically.
And boom, you start making deals and getting things done. And like we said, the people in the Freedom Caucus are screaming bloody murder.
And Bader is like, fuck you, you know.
Basically.
Yeah, basically.
And the thing with all of these is they are, of course, things where the Republicans get some of what they want. The Democrats get some of what they want. And, yeah. You know, you make some trade-offs and some deals and, you know, you push things along and everybody gets a little bit, but nobody gets everything. And, you know, that's how compromise works. That's how moving things along works, usually. So. Right. Any Congress doing anything else crazy? Oh, there is. And I have not followed this anywhere nearly as well as I should have. But the Senate just passed the bill on sharing of data and information between companies, the government, et cetera, specifically online data. And it looks like it's billed as a cybersecurity bill, but it really has very little about actual cybersecurity stuff in it, and it's mostly about making sure that the paths of communication are clear, so that if the government wants to get information from, say, Facebook or Google, they can do so easily, and the people who are getting their information given to the government don't really have a way to know about it or appeal or do anything about it. And so the internet privacy groups are all about how horrible this is and how this is really a spying bill that's enabling all kinds of things. And also, by the way, making it easier for companies to share information amongst themselves, even when the government's not involved. I believe that is correct. Please, if any of our listeners knows differently, like I said, I haven't followed this as closely as I should have. But anyway, from everything I know about this, this is a disastrous bill, but it looks like it's going to fly through Congress and get signed by the president.
How did he get this damn thing through? Anyway,
Because it's one of those things that it's all couched in national security terms. It's all couched in we have to do this to be safer, blah blah blah. And for the most part, Congress is full of technological illiterates who have no fucking clue how any of this works or why it might be important. So they end up making things that are going to fundamentally change the nature of, how information is shared or not shared or, how private things are on the internet. And, they just don't give a shit.
Interesting.
This is another one of those things where, I've said before, when you do get the few things where Republicans and Democrats are, sort of aligned. Those are actually the things to be the most scared about.
Okay. Well, shit. All right.
Yeah, so like I said, I probably, I need to read up a little bit more on this, but what little I've read has all been...
not good.
Not good. And again, I trust the sort of people like the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and other sort of internet privacy groups. Over the people who are screaming about national security and cybersecurity, because I mean, like, one of the I forget, maybe it was Dianne Feinstein or whatever in a hearing last week or the week before was talking about cybersecurity threats and basically made a statement that whether directly or implied, I forget, said that when hackers basically do distributed denial of service attacks on bank websites, that's a more serious threat than the exposure of all the government contractor information from that database that was hacked from the government, where they took all of everybody's personnel files from everybody who worked for the government, including, the forms people fill out when they apply for security clearances and such. And it's like, really?
Really?
Really? Like,
how the hell could she come to that conclusion?
You can you can disrupt a website fairly cheaply.
Right.
And it's not even
an issue. And by the way, it usually comes back up pretty soon. They can't sustain the attacks like forever.
Right. You know? I mean, it's not even an if you know what you're doing kind of thing. The tools are easily available. There was a thing this week as well that former CIA director Brennan had his AOL account compromised by some 13-year-old kid who guessed his password. Well, actually, I think he did the social engineering thing where he called to do a password reset, whatever. But anyway, it was a 13-year-old kid following, you know, fairly easy to understand processes to get in. It wasn't even really a hack. You know, it's just...
Jeez. But that's the way that they get... You know, that's the funniest thing. That's... You know, I've talked about some of the biggest hacks. That's the way that they've been happening. It's more social engineering than anything else.
No, I know. But anyway, the bottom line is, you know, and we talked about this with Clinton in her email, too. And I know we need to move on. But it's one of the things that is very, very worrying to me is how often we've got politicians who are completely and totally clueless about anything developed after 1980, making significant decisions about the future of those technologies and how they're going to work. And it's just scary because they're all these people and they have no freaking clue. And so they're easily manipulated by people who just use scary words. And, you know, oh my God, they took down Chase Bank. Well, you know, no, they disrupted the website for a few minutes.
Right.
You know? Anyway, whatever. Before I stop, I did find one poll that I had been looking for here on the appeal of Carson. And this was a poll. This was a Des Moines Register and Bloomberg Politics poll. From a little over a week ago, I guess. And they asked people, I'm going to mention some things people have said about Ben Carson. Regardless of whether you support him for president, please tell me, for each of these things, is it something you find attractive, mostly attractive, unattractive, or very unattractive?
All right.
Okay. And so, combining the very attractive and mostly attractive, so here are the positive things that people, reasons people liked Carson. Okay, so the top first, I'll mention the top five, and then I'll mention a couple others that are noticeable. The top five, 96% liked that he approaches issues with common sense. 89% liked him because he was guided by his faith in God. 88% because he was a highly successful neurosurgeon. Mm-hmm. And obviously these add up to more than 100%. They're all things that people can like more than one thing.
Right.
85% not a career politician. 85% inspirational personal story. And so those are the five things that sort of people like the most about Carson. And okay, those are interesting, but sort of somewhat predictable, I guess. Here are a few others that are worth noting. 81% like him because he has said that the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, is the worst thing since slavery. 73% like him because he has raised questions about whether a Muslim should ever be president of the United States.
How much was the percentage? 70 what?
73.
Okay.
And 77%.
Okay, let's be clear here to anybody who may have doubts about that. I'm not going to call you a name. Obama is not a Muslim.
Yes.
Just FYI.
And 77% like him because he has said that Hitler might not have been as successful if the people had been armed. And interestingly enough, 31% like him because he has conducted research on tissue from aborted fetuses.
That's an interesting combo.
Yeah. Anyway, enough about the politics stuff. Let's take
a basically, you're telling me that according to the polling data, that he's being backed by lunatics.
Well, yeah. Okay. There are a few of those questions that.
Okay. Let's be clear. Okay. Let's wait. Which, you know, let's see. Which one do you think, if you chose, was the most loony answer that people gave?
I'd say the Hitler one.
Exactly. Give me a break.
Anyway, moving on, let's take a break and we'll talk about tech for a little bit.
All right.
Back after this.
Information.
Okay, we are back. So, okay. Yvonne, we've been talking for a while how we used to talk about tech all the freaking time, but lately it's been politics, election, news, politics, election, news. We haven't talked very much on tech recently, and this has been sort of the season for a lot of tech news over the last few weeks, and you're at a tech conference right now as well. So, you said you'd guide this segment on tech, so let's talk a few.
So let me ask you a question, because before I came to this conference, so I got to see on Sunday keynote speeches by the CEO of Intel Corporation, whose name I can't remember because they named this guy who even his employees were calling him by his initials because it's a complicated name, and Larry Ellison.
Okay.
You know, was, if you guys don't know, I mean, he's one of the top five, I think it's at least in the top 10 richest people in the world. Number three, I think, in the U.S., if I remember correctly. Founder of Oracle, great buddy of Steve Jobs. I mean, he was on the board of Apple for a long time. I mean, like, Steve had asked him on the board. He had resigned later because he said he was too busy. Couldn't do, but he's been a guy that has been a very... his company has been a very strong presence in Silicon Valley during their entire time. Very acquisitive, bought a lot of companies. Look, his software is in every big Fortune 1000 company, you know, in the back end. I mean, Apple, for example, Apple's all their e-commerce and everything, their accounting systems, everything run on Oracle, okay, on the back end. So it's the thing is that I'm going through the speeches, right? And I'm hearing about some of the stuff and I started feeling like a moron.
Okay.
Right. Let me ask you this question, because this is something that I got presented. Then I have to start reading up on this because I had no idea of this term or what the hell it is. Had you heard of Hadoop?
Yes.
Okay. Then you're smarter than I am.
Yes, I have heard that term bandied around for quite a few years.
Okay, you've heard the term bandied. Do you know what the fuck it is?
It's a very rough way of talking about it. Is it's a way for dealing with large data sets through something called MapReduce, which is a specific technology for doing stuff.
Okay.
The basic technique is it breaks a very large project up into small bits that can be done in parallel, so that instead of having one big computer run it, you farm it out to like potentially hundreds or thousands of smaller computers that do the parts and report back, and then the results get put together.
Okay, now you're talking about now there's two pieces, because Hadoop, that's the file system. Okay, all right. You talked about the file system, because Hadoop also is that's the MapReduce, which you're right. But also there are two pieces. You've got that the Hadoop Common, the Hadoop file system, Hadoop Yarn.
You're looking at the Wikipedia page.
Yeah, because I pull it up. Okay.
I have it up too. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, here's the thing. Now, the main thing about Hadoop to understand is, I mean, there's two pieces here, because one is really in order to, okay, this is what, and then I understood what Facebook and Yahoo and other, well, Facebook is one of the biggest users, where their entire compute platform is basically sitting on this. They just buy a lot of, you know, just, they have a lot of hardware. Actually, I know that years ago when I was at HP, they bought for the most part almost all, you know, servers from HP. Right. Fucking like we're sticking them in a room. And what they did is that they installed this on there basically in order to build a large array of computing. And basically Hadoop is what managed this. Okay, all right. It just basically allows you to plug and play all these freaking components in there. And you had your two sections, which are your file system, and you had your section, which was the compute part, in which basically it's just this big cluster of computers that just basically acts as, well, you can partition it in whichever ways you want it. Okay, all right. It's just, you know, it's all the components are basically, to the system, they are act as they are invisible. Okay, all right. You, if one fails, you pull it out, you put one in. Now, I mean, this, you know, I got to be honest. You heard of the term. I got to admit, I've been selling technology for years. This is what I do for a living. I got to be straight. I had not heard of this term. I really felt like an idiot. Okay, all right. Can I be honest?
Okay.
But the thing is that this is where computing, you know, you've got a lot of companies out there that had this traditional server infrastructure, you know, where they had dedicated servers. And I still have a lot of companies that have dedicated servers for each individual application. Mm-hmm. And there are still a lot of companies with that. And then a lot of companies started moving to these virtualized servers who started using VMware, whatever, whatnot, which basically, you know, you were using just, you know, you would combine all these servers into an infrastructure, and then you would stand up all these servers using, you know, just create images using of Windows and inside these. This is different, even to a different extent. Now, the one thing is that, after seeing a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about, I mean, this is like, I mean, this is the future. Okay, all right. I mean, we're, you know, in the last, what I saw 3 years ago, I talked to customers, and almost like over 90% of them would not consider moving anything out into the cloud.
Right.
Okay. It was just scary to them. Whatever, I lose control, blah, blah, blah. Larry showed at the presentation that last year, new business that they sold, almost 70% of it was new business was cloud licensing.
Yeah.
That their model of selling, you know, licensing to be in a data center is dying at an incredibly fast rate. I talked to a number of developers and people that are in key engineering positions at Oracle, and they told me that they were just shocked at how quickly it happened, because it happened like just like this. I mean, it was just crazy. Okay.
Right. I mean, there was basically a tipping point where people, well, you know, lots of startups embrace the technology very quickly, but for legacy businesses, there's a tipping point where they saw sort of enough new companies basing what they were doing on this at large scale and having it work successfully that they're like, wait a second, are we throwing away money not doing this?
You're throwing away tons of money. And I, you know, the thing also, I think like a couple of years ago when you were talking about this, you know, we've talked about security breaches and how companies haven't given a shit or whatever. One of the things that he spoke about in the keynote was the fact that for many years, like Oracle would ship their software with security features that were in there, but they were like really turned off. It was really, we would go, we would send the security features, we would show the customers how to do them, and turning them off was their option.
Yeah.
And then we realized as we went back is that he said we were stupid, okay, because we should have had them all on by default.
Right.
Because what happened is that a lot of people just didn't turn them on. And that's one of the reasons why we've had so many problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the new changes that he said is like right now, you know what? Everything in security is coming out. It is, everything's coming out with security turned on. You want to actively turn off the security, then you have to make a choice to go and actively say you don't want that security.
Right.
But we're not doing this shit anymore. Okay? All right? Flat out thing number one. Number two is that he spent already the last 2 years rewriting everything for the cloud. I mean, and they are so into the cloud that it's like everything that you've got here, we're not doing anything that's not the cloud. But the other part was how quickly he said that the competitive landscape has changed, that even like when he's identifying his competitors, when he talked about who his old competitors were, his old competitors were IBM, SAP. Basically, he's like, those people don't exist to me anymore. He actually said that flat out, which is kind of funny because IBM was one of the big sponsors of the conference. Okay.
Nice.
Basically just said they're irrelevant. You know, the competitors right now that he says are his key competitors are Amazon Web Services, Workday, and Salesforce. Those are the key three companies that he's targeting in. He doesn't give a shit about the other ones anymore. Mm-hmm. They said that that's what's happening in the future. And that's what we're focused on right now. And, you know, the other terms, I mean, I've heard, you know, the term SaaS has been around, like, whatever, you know, and I guess
software as a service for those.
Software as a service. I know. We're talking a little bit more, a lot more about, and I mean, I've heard about in general what these things do, but not a framework of the process, because he's separated everything now into SaaS, PaaS, and IaaS. So they basically
SaaS, say what those stand for.
SaaS, software as a service, platform as a service, and infrastructure as a service. And how basically that's the way that the future is going. Okay, nobody is buying hardware anymore. This is all bullshit. This is all going away. But what you're getting is you're going to get these three components in order to build your stuff. Okay, you're going to get you need infrastructure as a service. Okay, all right. So you need storage servers, you need things or whatever, whatnot, stuff like that. You need a platform. So all these development platforms, software, whatever, whatnot, that people sometimes need to build on top. And then you're going to get applications that sit on top of it. And that's the way that the entire design is structured. And it's just amazing to me to see how that's just – I mean, I'm telling you, 5 years ago, the last tech conference that I went to was an HP tech conference 5 years ago. None of this, we were talking about this. As a matter of fact, we were talking about building, helping customers build bigger data centers and how they were going to build their own data centers and how to plan their data centers and stuff, whatever, whatnot. I mean, shit, that's what I was talking in front of customers. And now all this is like gone. Nothing. I mean, and sometimes we talk about supposedly how technology is not moving that fast. I mean, shit, I just sat over there and I realized, holy fucking shit, this whole thing is like, I mean, I felt like a dinosaur, gotta be honest. The other terms I learned, streaming SQL, you ever heard of this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a deep... I am technology adjacent. I would not put myself. Yeah, I'm not a developer. I'm not a coder. I'm not a thing. But yeah, I've heard the term. I haven't dealt.
Okay,
with it.
So that was another one that I was learning about. Okay, all right. We're going to talk. How about Spark? You heard about Spark?
No.
Okay, Spark is Spark. If I understood correctly, was a competitor. Is basically like a competitor to Hadoop.
Okay,
all right. So that's another one of those. So it was just. I mean, for somebody, I mean, I have worked in technology and talk about this all the damn time. I just felt like a lot of this stuff has really come on, like, really recently. And it's just amazing. I mean,
you were talking Hadoop, the first, you know, full release was in 2011. There were pre-release versions before that, I'm pretty sure. But, you know, it all depends on the industry you're in. Like I said, I've been hearing these terms for years and years and years. It doesn't seem all that sudden to me because I've been in a space that's been very aggressive about using these technologies.
Well, yeah,
but,
agreed.
And frankly, a company that does some of it. But the you've been more in a space that deals with a lot of... legacy companies that move a lot slower. And my previous position, you know, I was at Merrill Lynch way back when, and you know, that's not the kind of company that jumps on things quickly. That's the kind of company that takes their time. And I've heard of these things classified into sort of waves in terms of, you know, companies just like people. There are early adopter kind of companies that are always on the cutting edge, and then there's some in between folks, and then there's like the really conservative ones that aren't going to even touch something until it's completely and totally solid.
Agreed, but there's a lot. I mean, it's amazing. Like, there's such a varied spectrum of these, obviously. And you know, I'm going over here. I'm looking at this, and a lot of companies, because this is really the wave of the future. And it's like sometimes it stuns me. You know, it's like it's the same thing as the late adoption of security or like this stuff, right? Look, I was talking, you know, recently I was talking about a company where, you know, we discovered that they had a company that had hundreds of servers, okay, that were using Windows Server 2003, which is unsupported, okay, by Microsoft, okay, at this point. And these were not virtualized servers. These were actual standing boxes that still had applications in them. I mean, this is a server version that came out freaking 2003. It came out 12 years ago. I'm pretty sure it did come out in 2003, you know, because sometimes Microsoft names stuff with years and it's not the year that it came out, but I'm pretty sure it came out then. I mean, shit. I mean, really? Really? I mean, when I heard of how many of those were standing, it just boggled my mind. But the reality is that there's a lot of companies
Let alone the federal government and things like that, which, you know, we were talking about those hacks and, you know, some of the excuses people gave being about, hey, there's this old stuff written in like COBOL from the 1960s that we haven't been able to upgrade the security because they haven't come out with the right libraries for COBOL yet.
Well, I mean, but there's even solutions to that. The reason is that people don't move fast enough with that. I mean, I was like one company that I actually had heard about this company. There's a company out there that already provides virtualization services for you to like take those damn instances on those fucking mainframes and putting on a virtual environment and run it there so you don't even have to have that anymore.
Most people are doing that kind of stuff. It's not like they're actually running on 1960s hardware for the most part. But
some people are.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. I mean, don't disabuse yourself. I mean, those are people, maybe not 1960s hardware, certainly pretty damn, certainly like there's a lot of people still running 20-year-old hardware.
Right.
I mean, the FAA was running on 2020. I mean, running hardware so damn old, like it was like almost impossible to maintain in a lot of instances. So, you know, but I guess I don't know.
Yeah, just to give one example, I remember reading an article about somebody who did a day in the life of some air traffic controller, maybe in LaGuardia or somewhere, and one of the things they noticed was that there was a status tracking board or something about that was run by an old TI-99 computer.
Oh, man!
And if you remember, these were like...
Yes, when I was like 9 years old.
Yeah, it wasn't used for directly like controlling planes or anything.
It was just a status board.
It was like a status board kind of thing. But like if that thing went down, they were like, I don't know what we'd do. I guess we'd use like markers on a whiteboard, you know?
God, come on. TI-99. I mean, wow.
Anyway.
Well, I guess I'll say something about Texas Instruments. I mean, shit, that thing lasted that long working. Damn.
Yeah.
Not bad build. But anyway, I guess that was my main thing. I just think it's, you know, sometimes we talk about lack of progress in technology. And I was like, I mean, honestly, I guess maybe because I spend so much time dealing with like legacy technology and helping people just get out of that, you know, you don't spend enough time looking at what the hell is coming out that's new. Okay. All right. You know, I was like sitting, you know, it's one of the reasons I wanted to come out to one of these conferences. I told my boss, I'm like, damn it, I hadn't come out to a conference in like 5 years. I need to go out to something. I need to find out what the fuck is going on in the future.
And the whole world has changed in 5 years.
I know. I was like, fuck. I was like feeling like, Jesus Christ. I feel like, fuck, I feel like a moron. So I'm going to ensure that I participate more frequently in the conferences. in order to not be feel like a total antiquated dinosaur at this point is my current my current goal for that.
We are just doomed to be dinosaurs, Yvonne.
But I'm sure. I don't know. I'm not going to feel that bad. But aside from that,
yes.
This week on other tech news that we had.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of people were worried about technology, about the economy, and it came out that a number of technology companies announced like earnings. Okay, all right. And all of a sudden, it was like massive. You know, everybody's like, oh my God, look at that. Even with the currency impacts of, you know, the US dollar getting very strong and whatever, whatnot, you know, Apple, Google, Microsoft all announced like, you know, excellent earnings. Even Twitter, like that's been in trouble, they just named a new CEO, also showed like improved earnings. Now, I love this quote that I did pick up on Apple's earnings. Okay, all right. Here's the quote. Apple's revenues for fiscal 2015, okay, increased roughly by Apple's revenue for fiscal 2015. This is a quote from an article in the Wall Street Journal. Increased by roughly $51 billion, which is more than all but 55 members of the Fortune 500, including Pfizer and Walt Disney.
Right. So the amount of increase is bigger than the total size.
Correct.
Of
Yeah. It's pretty nuts. Can I be honest? So Apple like reported, you know, everybody's been like scared that supposedly like Apple's going to fall off a cliff for whatever the hell reason that nobody could really explain. And lo and behold, the sky didn't fall and Apple kept selling more than before. And so that was a big thing on that this week, you know, record shipments on everything. As the PC market keeps contracting, Apple keeps selling more PCs for whatever reason. You know, they were showing that the PC market contracted last quarter 13%, and Apple grew shipments of Macs by 3% in a 13% contracting market.
You mentioned Facebook and Twitter as well. What's the
Twitter also announced like earnings were up, but I think there's more concerns about where Twitter's going.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you heard, they did name a new CEO. They did basically bring back their old CEO
brought back one of the founders.
One of the founders who the thing is that he's not a full-time CEO. He's splitting his time with Square,
right.
the payment site. So there's a lot of concern about his focus on the job. Now, he came in and, you know, I think, you know, we had this discussion about where Twitter's heading a few months back.
Yep.
That you're trying to monetize, trying to do a couple of things. Look, I think that he's realized that they were trying to just do too much too quickly to a certain extent. And one of the things that he did is I think that they had ramped up their employees like almost like doubled in a very short amount of time. And he said they're targeting layoffs. They're going to get rid of people.
They did lay off a bunch of people.
He did lay off a bunch of people, recently. And, I think he's just trying to refocus the company at this point. And I'm hoping that it's not going to lose its focus, because I think that you and I agree. I mean, I like the service.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole damn problem is how the hell they're going to make money on it. And they're having a tough time figuring that out.
Yeah. And all of the things that are most likely to make money have the potential side effect of screwing up the things that people like about the service.
Well, I'll give you an example of shit that I like hate. Okay. And this is not Twitter itself doing it. It's some other sites that are doing this. I like, one of the sites that I go to for like technology news is news.com. Okay. All right. It's seen at site. They got some tech news or whatever. I check out the sites, but I've for years I read that site. Annoyingly lately, they are inserting fucking ads that look like it's an article, okay, inside their news feed.
Yes.
Okay? So you're going through the news feed and you think it's a news thing, and then I have accidentally done this like twice and I clicked on it and find out it's not a fucking article, it's an ad.
Right.
And that shit is annoying as all hell.
And this is part of the response to ad blockers and just lower responsiveness to traditional ads as well. I mean, it's the equivalent of the paid placement in TV shows and stuff where, you know, the characters in the show take off a few seconds to talk about the wonders of the car they're driving.
Yes.
And it's like, what the hell, you know, but, and especially, I will say, those are specifically very out of place. Like, if you're listening to, if you're watching older shows from like a few years ago, and you see those kind of product placements, they really stand out, perhaps even more than if it was when you're brand new, because they're also promoting a product that's old. But yeah, it's equivalent of that, and more places are doing it. All kinds of websites and you know, print stuff too, for the few things that are still doing print. But it's all over the place, and I agree. It's very, very annoying. And there are unclear standards. Like, some places do better than others of clearly highlighting in a way that's obvious that it's an advertisement.
Oh, but, no, the fucking assholes at news.com make it that, you know, unless you're really paying attention, you can't tell the fucking difference.
Right.
It is really annoying.
And of course, that's the value in it. The less people can tell the difference, and the more people are fooled into thinking it's a real part of the editorial, the more valuable it is to the advertiser.
Oh, God. Well, that's disgusting. That's really pissing me off. So I guess, you know, so go back. I mean, the reason I'm saying that is because Twitter, I think one of the things, I mean, Twitter has been doing that in their Twitter app, okay, all right, doing that. And I mean, you know, sponsored tweets and that kind of stuff and shit. And I don't know. It just seems to, I mean, I get, they got to make money.
Well, this is, again, like, every time I look at Twitter, I shake my head and I'm like, I wish they had just said, ah, fuck it. let's go the Wikipedia route.
Right.
You know, because this is something that is very useful as a service that maybe there is no good way to monetize it without killing it, but it's still valuable. And so how can you do this in such a way that, you know, and if you'd done it at a very early time when it was still private, you could potentially have taken it down that sort of road, where you just do the minimum to keep the basic service up and running. And, you know, you have an annual fundraiser or something. But now
These guys wanted a payoff I understand. I'm sure they were, you know, their initial idea of putting this together wasn't just, you know, as a nonprofit. I totally get that. I just wish, I mean, I'm trying to figure out ways that to do what they're looking for, but without just it doing that kind of like shady crap that I'm talking about.
Well, and the thing is, there are probably ways that they could make it a profitable going concern that, without destroying it, but that's different than having it be, you know, a mega company that's going to be worth the valuations that it has and make the stockholders happy. Like, I could see Twitter being a profitable small company.
Yeah, and the problem is that you get this massive pressure, especially with all the focus that a company like as Twitter has, you know, to grow like in outsized ways and perform. And, you know, it's just, it's hard to resist that pressure. I mean, especially when you've got that much people like with their eyes and ears and look on you, you know, I mean, you're a smaller company, doesn't get that much publicity or whatever, but you know, your earnings every time they come out, they're on the frickin' cover of every damn magazine. Everybody's scrutinizing you down to the last move. You know, you got so many people paying attention to it that it's hard to resist that pressure. I will tell you that it's one of the reasons I know, you know, that for example, Michael Dell decided that he needed to do a big change at Dell. And if he was at the public eye, he figured that this was just, you know, not going to happen. So he took the damn company private. You know, he just said, I mean, you know, to make this transformation, because it's just by being public, we're just not going to be able to do it in a way that, you know, without this constant hounding by everybody about what we're doing.
Right.
So, okay. And of course, anyway.
I think right. We should wrap things up. I don't think we need a lightning round. I am going to mention one quick thing. I do my books as part of the lightning round, but this one's about to roll off the log I keep, so I'm going to throw it out. I finished a book called The Scarlet Plague, this was an audiobook again. Most of the time when I say I finish a book, it's an audiobook. The Scarlet Plague by Jack London, written in 1912. It takes place in 2073, after there was sort of a plague that depopulated the whole planet. Basically, I believe the word they were throwing out, like, one out of a million people survived this plague. They basically follow this character as he's talking about what happened during that plague. And it was a fairly short novel. I don't know. It didn't end up doing a lot for me in the end. Mm-hmm. It had because it was basically just, okay, there was a plague and here's how everybody died. And then I was alone. And then society fell apart. And they're starting to rebuild, but they're primitives now. And boom, I just told you the whole book.
You know? Wow.
And
well, that didn't take long.
Yeah. And I mean, there were some interesting little vignettes in it, but basically, this was, a very early of the sort of post-apocalyptic kind of, novels, but it really was sketching out, hey, look, society can disappear overnight if the right set of things happens. And it was sort of like that concept was enough that was the book. Whereas now, if you write one of those kinds of things, there has to be more to it than just that. Whereas I felt like this was just, yeah, society was destroyed. Look at how much that sucks. And that was it.
End of story.
So anyway, that was one of the recent things I finished. So
okay.
And no lightning round this time. We'll come back and do another one next week, probably.
All right.
But we've gone on long enough. So yep. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in once again to Curmudgeon's Corner. And, you know, go see us on Facebook, like us on Facebook, share with your friends. Go to iTunes and review us. Come on. Somebody. iTunes.
Anybody.
Review.
Anybody.
Bueller.
Anyone.
Anyway, we love to hear your comments on Facebook and the website and anywhere else. Respond to us on Twitter as well. I'm at Abelsmay. Yvonne is at I am Bo. And tune in next week. In the meantime, have a great week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Yvonne.
Bye.
Later.